I'd rather lose everything than marry her. Arthur snapped, staring at the water stains mapping his study ceiling. It was Monday morning. The estate was completely bankrupt, creditors were circling like vultures, and the proposed bride was the daughter of an abrasive railway baron. Arthur despised new money. He despised the sheer transaction of it all. He swore he would never yield. Yet by Friday afternoon, he would be on one knee in the mud, offering her his mother's ring. The library of Westford Abbey smelled of damp wool decaying leather and the distinct metallic scent of cold ash. Arthur Pendleton IX, Duke of Westford, sat behind a massive mahogany desk that had been carved in a century when his family still mattered. Right now, it merely served as a resting place for the architecture of his ruin. Stacks of paper bound in cruel red twine formed jagged skylines across the wood. Promissory notes, bank demands, final notices. The red ink in the ledgers seemed to glow in the weak morning light filtering through the grime-frosted windows. Arthur rubbed his temples. He was 28, but his joints ached with the weather, and his eyes felt packed with sand. Harrison stood by the unlit hearth. The butler was a fixture of the room, as unmoving as the marble busts in the corridor, though significantly more frayed around the cuffs. His posture was immaculately straight. He held a silver tray. On the tray sat a single, crisp, unnervingly white envelope. "I am not reading it, Harrison," Arthur said. His voice was a low rasp, dry from the chill of the room. "It arrived by special courier an hour ago, Your Grace, from London." Harrison didn't move. He didn't push the tray forward. He simply stated the fact, letting it hang in the freezing air. "I know who it's from." Arthur pushed back his chair. It groaned in protest. He walked over to the tall windows, looking out over the front drive. The gravel was patchy, giving way to aggressive weeds. The grand fountain in the center of the turning circle had been dry for 6 years. The stone cherub atop it was missing an arm, looking less like a classical triumph and more like a casualty of war. "It's from Thomas Hammond, and he can take his railway fortune and choke on it. Mr. Hammond's solicitor made it clear that the offer expires at the end of the week, sir."
"It isn't an offer, Harrison. It's an acquisition."
Arthur turned, leaning against the cold glass. "He wants a title. He wants to buy his way into the House of Lords by slapping a coronet on his daughter's head. And he's chosen me because I'm the cheapest duke on the market. You are the most indebted duke on the market." "Your Grace," Harrison corrected mildly. He finally stepped forward, placing the letter on the desk, right on top of a foreclosure notice from the Royal Bank. "There is a distinction." Arthur glared at the butler. "I will not sell my name." "Your father already sold it, sir. At the baccarat tables in Monte Carlo and the betting rings in Ascot." Harrison's tone never wavered. There was no judgment, only an agonizingly precise recitation of facts. "Mr. Hammond is simply offering to buy back the receipt." Arthur crossed the room and picked up the letter. The seal was thick, ostentatious wax. New money always tried too hard. He cracked it open. The paper was heavy expensive. He skimmed the demands. Hammond would clear the estate's debts, all £80,000 of them. He would establish a trust for the Abbey's upkeep. In exchange, Arthur would marry Beatrice Hammond before the end of the season. "Have you met her?" Arthur asked, tossing the letter back onto the desk. "The daughter?" "I have not had the pleasure, Your Grace. She's 24. Unmarried." In a family with that much money, an unmarried daughter at 24 means she is entirely insufferable. Probably loud. Doubtless ill-mannered. She'll want the house gutted and filled with gilded French monstrosities. Arthur paced the length of the rug, taking care to step over the threadbare patch near the armchair. "I'd rather lose everything than marry her." Harrison picked up the silver tray and tucked it under his arm.
Very well, Your Grace. Shall I inform the staff?
Arthur stopped.
Inform them of what?
That they are dismissed. If you decline Mr. Hammond's offer, the bank will seize the property by the first of the month. We have 14 indoor servants, remaining many of whom have nowhere else to go. Cook is 62. The groundskeeper is practically blind. They will need time to secure lodging in the workhouses before the winter sets in properly. The words hit Arthur like a physical blow to the ribs. He looked at Harrison. The butler's face was a polite mask, but his eyes held a quiet, devastating sorrow. Harrison had practically raised him. "You're manipulating me," Arthur said quietly. "I am arranging the schedule, sir," Harrison replied. "A butler must always anticipate the needs of the household, even when there is no house left." Arthur looked back at the desk. The red ink, the white envelope, the crushing weight of 400 years of history narrowing down to a single humiliating choice. He gritted his teeth, the muscles in his jaw ticking. "Pack my overnight bag," Arthur said, his voice dropping to a hollow surrender. "I'm taking the noon train to London."
"To accept the proposal, sir,
to meet the executioner," Arthur muttered. "If I am to sell my life, I want to look the buyer in the eye when I tell him my terms." The Hammond residence in Mayfair was exactly what Arthur expected, yet somehow worse. It lacked the quiet, faded dignity of old estates. Instead, it was aggressively immaculate. The marble floors gleamed so brightly they looked wet. The gas lamps hissed a steady, opulent warmth. It smelled of beeswax, exotic flowers, and fresh paint. Arthur stood in the drawing room, his worn woolen coat feeling heavy and coarse against the velvet upholstery of the chair he refused to sit in. He was prepared for Thomas Hammond. He was prepared for a booming voice, a thick cigar, and the smug satisfaction of a self-made man buying aristocracy. He was not prepared for the door to open and reveal a woman holding a stack of leather-bound folios. She didn't pause in the doorway to make an entrance. She walked in with the brisk, efficient stride of someone who had far too much to do. She wore a dark green day dress, practical and entirely devoid of the excessive ruffles currently in vogue. Her dark hair was pinned up ruthlessly, a few strands escaping near her neck. She walked straight to a heavy oak side table, dropped the folios with a loud thud, and finally turned to look at him. "You're early," she said. Her voice was clear, low, and entirely unimpressed. Arthur blinked. "I beg your pardon. My father's telegram said you would arrive on the 3 o'clock train. It is currently 1:15. She pulled a silver pocket watch from her skirt and checked it, then snapped it shut. "I assume you skipped lunch. A tactical error, Duke. Pride is easier to swallow on a full stomach." Arthur's spine stiffened. "You are Beatrice Hammond."
"I am."
She walked over to him, extending a hand. He stared at it for a fraction of a second before taking it. Her grip was firm. He noticed a smudge of black ink on the side of her index finger. "I was under the impression I was meeting with your father," Arthur said, letting his hand drop. "My father is currently at the shipyards in Bristol, yelling at union organizers," Beatrice replied, moving past him to a sideboard to pour a glass of water. "He left me to handle the preliminary negotiations, though frankly there isn't much to negotiate. The terms were quite clear." She offered him the glass. He didn't take it. She shrugged and took a sip herself. They were clear. Arthur agreed, his voice turning cold. "Which is why I am here to decline them." Beatrice paused the glass halfway to her lips. For the first time she looked at him properly. Her eyes were a sharp, dark brown. They didn't sweep over him with the usual fawning admiration he got from London debutantes. They catalogued him. They took in the excellent cut of his jacket and the fact that it was 5 years out of fashion. They noticed the polished boots and the fact that the leather was scuffed at the toe. "Are you..."
she asked, setting the glass down. She didn't look angry. She looked mildly curious. May I ask why? Because marriage is not a business transaction. Arthur snapped the frustration of the past 24 hours boiling over. I am not a parcel of land to be bought, and you are not a railway line to be secured. Beatrice leaned against the sideboard, crossing her arms. Of course it's a business transaction. It has been for centuries. Your great-grandfather married the daughter of the Duke of Devonshire for a coal mine in Wales. Your father married your mother for her dowry to pay off his first round of debts. Why are you suddenly pretending your bloodline is built on poetry? The accuracy of her strike left him breathless for a moment. He narrowed his eyes. You speak rather bluntly for a lady. I speak like someone who actually balances the books, she retorted. You think my father's money is dirty? Your Grace, you think because he built his fortune out of iron and steam, it somehow lacks the dignity of wealth inherited through blood. She pushed off the sideboard and walked slowly toward him. But let me tell you what I think. I think you are perfectly willing to let your servants starve and your tenants freeze just so you can keep your hands clean. That isn't dignity. That's cowardice. Arthur felt a flush of heat rise in his cheeks. The memory of Harrison's quiet resignation the day before flashed through his mind. You know nothing of my estate, he said, his voice dangerously quiet. I know it carries £80,000 in debt, she countered, stopping 3 feet from him. I know the roof in your west wing is rotting. I know your tenants haven't had their cottages repaired in a decade. I know all of this because I drafted the contract my father sent you. Arthur stared at her. You drafted it. He wanted to offer you £60,000. I told him £80,000 was the minimum to prevent the bank from seizing the tenant farms. She looked him dead in the eye. I don't want to marry you, Arthur. I have no interest in pouring tea for snobs who will whisper behind their fans about my father's accent. But I am a practical woman. My father will never let me manage the company unless I give him the title he craves. He gets his earldom, I get my autonomy. She walked back to the oak table and picked up the top folio. Go back to your abbey, she said, not looking at him anymore. Look at the people who depend on you. Then write to my father. If you truly wish to burn your house down to keep your pride warm, I won't stop you. But don't do it in my drawing room. Arthur stood there for a long moment. He had come here expecting a spoiled heiress. He had met a general. Without a word, he turned on his heel and walked out. The journey back to Westford took 6 hours. By the time the carriage turned onto the rutted drive of the abbey, the sky had bruised into a deep, violently purple dusk. A storm was rolling in from the north, the wind howling through the ancient oaks that lined the road, stripping them of their dead leaves. Arthur sat in the cold carriage, his mind playing Beatrice Hammond's words on an endless, agonizing loop. Cowardice. She had called him a coward. The worst part was, as the dark silhouette of the abbey loomed into view, he knew she was right. He stepped out into the biting wind. The front doors opened before he reached the steps. Harrison stood there holding a flickering oil lamp. Welcome back, Your Grace, Harrison said. The wind caught the flame, casting wild shadows across the butler's lined face. Thank you, Harrison. Arthur stepped inside, pulling off his gloves. The grand hall felt colder than the outdoors. Has the bank sent anyone? Not yet, sir. However, Mr. Finch from the village came by. The roof on his cottage caved in under the weight of the rain this morning. His wife is ill. I took the liberty of allowing them to sleep in the servants' hall by the kitchen fire. Arthur stopped dead. The roof caved in. Yes, sir, the timbers were rotten. We have lacked the funds for repairs since the spring. Arthur closed his eyes. I know your tenants haven't had their cottages repaired in a decade. Beatrice's voice echoed in his head, sharp as shattered glass. Did you tell him I would make it right? Arthur asked, his voice trembling slightly. Harrison hesitated. It was a microscopic pause, but for a man of Harrison's discipline, it was a scream. I told him, sir, that you were doing everything in your power. Before Arthur could reply, a deafening crack echoed through the house, followed by a heavy shuddering thud that rattled the floorboards beneath their feet. Dust rained down from the vaulted ceiling of the hall. What in God's name was that? Arthur shouted over the sudden roar of rain against the high windows. The West Wing, sir, Harrison said, his voice remarkably calm. I believe the gallery ceiling has finally given way. Arthur didn't wait for a lantern. He sprinted down the dark corridor, his boots echoing sharply on the stone. He threw open the double doors to the portrait gallery. The wind hit him immediately. A massive section of the roof had collapsed, bringing tons of slate, rotted wood and plaster crashing down onto the floor. Rain poured through the gaping hole in the ceiling like a waterfall, soaking the antique Persian rug and splashing against the walls. Arthur stood frozen in the doorway. To his left, a massive oil painting of the Second Duke hung askew, water streaming down the aristocratic painted face, making it look as though the ancestor was weeping. Below it, Thomas the elderly groundskeeper was on his hands and knees in the pooling water, desperately trying to drag a heavy, velvet-upholstered chaise out of the deluge. He was panting, his thin frame shaking with the effort. Thomas! Arthur ran forward, grabbing the other end of the chair. Stop, leave it! The old man looked up, his face pale and wet. It's ruined, Your Grace. The water, it's ruining everything. I know, Arthur said, hauling the chair backward. It doesn't matter. Get out of the cold. But the portrait, sir, the tapestries. I said leave it, Arthur yelled, his voice cracking. He grabbed Thomas by the shoulders and pulled him away from the pouring rain. Go to the kitchens, get dry. Thomas gave a shaky nod and hobbled out of the gallery. Arthur stood alone in the wreckage. The rain soaked through his coat, chilling him to the bone, but he didn't care. He looked at the shattered debris of his home. He looked at the portraits of the men who had built this place and the men who had slowly bled it dry. He had spent his whole life trying to be different from his father. His father had been reckless, gambling away fortunes on horses and cards. Arthur had prided himself on being careful, on being stoic, on protecting the honor of the name. But as he stared at the ruined gallery, he realized the bitter truth. His father had destroyed the estate out of vice. Arthur was destroying it out of vanity. He was letting an old man drag furniture through freezing water. He was letting a tenant's wife sleep on a stone floor because her roof had collapsed. He was choosing his own comfort, his own pristine, untouched ego, over the survival of the people he was born to protect. You're perfectly willing to let your staff go hungry to keep your hands clean. Arthur dropped to his knees in the rubble. The freezing water soaked through his trousers. He picked up a piece of a shattered porcelain vase, turning the sharp painted edge over in his numb fingers. He had lost. Beatrice Hammond had beaten him, not with money but with a mirror. He stayed there until the rain soaked through to his skin, until the cold numbed the ache in his chest. Then he stood up, dropped the porcelain shard, and walked back to his study. Harrison was waiting outside the door. Fetch me some dry paper and a working pen. Harrison, Arthur said quietly, not meeting the butler's eyes. Sir, I have a letter to write to Thomas Hammond, and after that, send a telegram to his daughter. Arthur finally looked up. His eyes were red-rimmed, his expression entirely stripped of its former haughtiness. There was only a raw, grounded exhaustion left. Tell her I am coming back to London on Thursday. The Hammond Railway Company headquarters sat in the belly of the city, a hulking fortress of soot-stained brick and iron facing the Thames. It did not smell of beeswax and orchids like the Mayfair townhouse. It smelled of sulphur burning coal and sweat. The noise was a physical entity, a constant rhythmic mechanical thumping that vibrated up through the soles of Arthur's boots. He stood in the centre of the drafting room, a cavernous space filled with slanted wooden tables and men in shirt sleeves shouting over the din of the rail yard outside. He felt entirely alien. He wore his only remaining respectable suit, a charcoal worsted wool that suddenly felt like medieval armour. A clerk, a young man with a heavy smudge of graphite across his nose, pointed a trembling finger toward a glass-panelled office at the far end of the floor. Arthur walked toward it, dodging hurried men carrying rolls of vellum. He didn't knock on the glass door. He just opened it. Beatrice was standing over a massive map pinned to a corkboard. She had a pencil behind her ear and a pair of brass dividers in her right hand. She didn't look up when the door clicked shut, cutting off the worst of the factory noise. "I told you to reroute the switchback around the chalk quarry, Mr. Davies," she said, her voice tight with irritation. "If we lay track over that limestone, the first heavy freeze will crack the foundation." "I am not Mr. Davies," Arthur said. Beatrice froze. Slowly she lowered the brass dividers and turned around. She was wearing a grey bodice unbuttoned at the collar, and her cuffs were rolled up to her elbows. For a fleeting second, surprise flickered in her sharp brown eyes, but she quickly smoothed it over with a look of mild business-like assessment. "No," she agreed. "You aren't." She walked over to her desk, tossing the dividers onto a stack of ledgers. "You sent a telegram. I didn't expect you to walk directly into the drafting room." "I am tired of waiting in drawing rooms," Arthur said. He didn't move further into the office. He stayed by the door, his hands clasped behind his back, to hide the slight tremor in his fingers. He had spent the entire train ride rehearsing a speech. It was a good speech. It was full of dignified concessions and rigid boundaries. But looking at her standing there with graphite on her fingers and the weight of a railway empire pulling at her shoulders, the speech evaporated. He realized with a sudden crushing clarity that she didn't care about his dignity. She only cared about the facts. "The roof of my west wing collapsed yesterday," Arthur said. The words tasted like ash. "The water destroyed a portrait of my grandfather and a Persian rug that has been in my family for a century." Beatrice crossed her arms. She didn't interrupt. She simply waited. "But that isn't why I am here," Arthur continued, forcing himself to hold her gaze. "I am here because a man named Finch, who has farmed my land for 40 years, had the roof of his cottage cave in over his sick wife's bed. And I do not have the money to buy them a blanket, let alone a beam of wood." He stopped. The mechanical thudding from the factory floor rattled the glass panes of the office. "I accept your father's terms," Arthur said. His voice was quieter now, stripped of all the haughty armor he had worn on Tuesday. It was just a bare, bleeding truth. "Clear the estate's debts, repair the tenant farms, establish the trust. In exchange, you will have your title, and your father will have his earldom." Beatrice stared at him. She didn't smile. She didn't gloat. There was no triumphant spark in her eyes. Instead, her posture softened just a fraction. "The tenant farms will be repaired first," she said. It wasn't a question. It was a decree. "Before the West Wing, before the Grand Hall, the people who bleed for your land will be housed before you get your Persian rug replaced." "Agreed. And the £80,000 goes into a restricted account. You don't have direct access to it to cover personal wages or gentlemen's debts. It pays the bank and it pays for the stone and mortar. I don't gamble, Miss Hammond." Arthur's jaw tightened. "My father was the addict. I am merely the man left holding his empty wallet." Beatrice watched him carefully for a long moment. Then she nodded a short, sharp dip of her chin. "My father is returning from Bristol tonight," she said, moving back to her desk and pulling a fresh sheet of paper from a drawer. "We will finalize the contract tomorrow morning at the townhouse, 9 o'clock. Don't be early this time." "I will be exactly on time," Arthur said. He turned to leave his hand on the brass doorknob. "Duke!" Beatrice called out. Arthur paused, looking back over his shoulder. She picked up her pencil, twirling it between her ink-stained fingers. "For what it's worth, it takes a certain kind of spine to admit when you're beaten. Most men in your position would have let the tenant freeze just to save face." "I almost did," Arthur replied, his voice heavy with self-disgust. "But you didn't." She looked back down at her papers. "See you at 9. Arthur walked out of the glass office and back into the deafening roar of the drafting room. He felt entirely hollowed out, but for the first time in 6 years, the suffocating grip of panic around his throat had loosened. He had sold himself, but his people would survive the winter. The London townhouse Arthur kept was a far cry from Westford Abbey. It was a narrow, dim terrace house in Marylebone, rented by the month and largely devoid of furniture. Harrison had preceded him on a later train, bringing only what was necessary for a prolonged stay in the city. Arthur sat in a wingback chair by a smoky, anemic fire. He held a small black velvet box in his hands. The velvet was worn bald at the corners. He popped the hinge. Inside, resting on faded white silk, was a ring. It was a square-cut sapphire flanked by two small, cloudy diamonds set in heavily tarnished silver. It was not a particularly grand ring. The Pendleton family jewels had long been sold off piece by piece to cover his father's debts at the card tables in Monte Carlo. This ring was the only piece that had survived. Because it hadn't belonged to the estate, it had belonged to his mother. She had worn it every day of her life. She had worn it while she poured tea, while she read in the garden, and while she quietly wept in her chambers when her husband's creditors came knocking. Arthur ran his thumb over the cold surface of the sapphire. The stone was scratched. "It could be polished, Your Grace," Harrison said, gently appearing from the shadows of the hallway, carrying a single glass of brandy on a tray. "No," Arthur said, snapping the box shut. "Leave the scratches, it's fitting." He took the brandy and swallowed half of it in one burning gulp. "Mr. Hammond will expect a formal proposal, sir," Harrison noted, taking the empty tray back. "The society papers are vicious. If there is no ring, no public declaration, they will immediately brand it a crude transaction. For the sake of the young lady's reputation, the theatre of it must be maintained." "The theatre of it," Arthur muttered bitterly. "She despises theatre as much as I do. She told me to my face she doesn't want to marry me, and yet she is doing so." Harrison stood by the fire, his hands clasped behind his back. "People do many things they do not wish to do, sir, when the alternative is unacceptable." Arthur looked at the closed velvet box. Beatrice was buying her freedom from her father's control. He was buying the survival of his estate. It was a clean, bloodless exchange of goods. So why did the thought of sliding his mother's ring onto Beatrice Hammond's ink-stained finger feel like such a heavy, insurmountable weight? The next morning at precisely 9 o'clock, Arthur stood in the drawing room of the Mayfair townhouse. The double doors swung open and Thomas Hammond entered. Hammond was a force of nature. He was a large man, barrel-chested, with a thick red beard and a tailored suit that strained across his shoulders. He didn't walk. He advanced. "Westford!" Hammond boomed, crossing the room in three massive strides. He grabbed Arthur's hand and pumped it violently. Hammond's grip was like a vice, his palms calloused despite his immense wealth. "I knew you'd come around. Took one look at the ledgers and realized pride doesn't put meat on the table, eh?" Arthur gritted his teeth, his jaw tight.
Mr. Hammond.
Thomas, lad. We're going to be family.
Hammond slapped Arthur on the shoulder, hard enough to rattle his teeth.
I told my solicitor, I said, the Duke's a smart boy. He won't let a little thing like old money pride stop a brilliant merger.
And here you are. Beatrice slipped into the room behind her father, silent as a shadow. She wore a dark blue dress today, her hair pulled back just as severely. She carried a thick leather portfolio.
Father, tone it down. You're giving him a migraine, Beatrice said, smoothly walking toward a heavy mahogany table in the center of the room.
She began pulling out stacks of paper.
Nonsense, B. The Duke and I understand each other.
Hammond beamed, pulling a thick gold cigar case from his pocket.
It's a beautiful thing, Westford. Your blood, my iron. Together we'll own half the county. Once we secure the earldom, those snobs at the Carlton Club won't be able to turn me away at the door.
Arthur stared at the man.
Hammond wasn't malicious. He was simply entirely devoid of tact, driven by a raw, hungry ambition that consumed all the air in the room. He was buying a human being, and he was thrilled with the purchase.
Arthur looked at Beatrice. She was arranging the contracts, her face an unreadable mask.
She didn't look at her father. She didn't look at Arthur. She just focused on the ink.
The contracts are ready, Beatrice said, tapping the edges of the paper against the table to align them.
The trust for the estate is heavily guarded. The funds for the tenant repairs will be released at noon today to the Bank of London. The remaining debts will be cleared by Monday.
Excellent, excellent, Hammond said, waving his unlit cigar.
Now about the proposal. The Times and the Post need a story. We can't just issue a press release like it's a new train route. We need Romance Westford. You need to get down on one knee, present a ring, the whole lot.
I am aware of how to propose, Mr. Hammond, Arthur said coldly.
Good. Tomorrow afternoon, I'm hosting a luncheon here for a few key investors. I want you to do it then, in front of witnesses, make a speech, give her a massive diamond.
Beatrice's head snapped up.
No.
Both men looked at her.
I am not a show pony, Father, Beatrice said, her voice dropping to a dangerous low octave.
You have your contract. You have your title. I will not stand in the middle of your drawing room like a prized heifer while your investors applaud.
Hammond frowned, his boisterous demeanor souring.
Baby reasonable. It's for the papers.
I said no.
Arthur watched the exchange. He saw the way Beatrice's knuckles turned white as she gripped the edge of the mahogany table. He saw the tight, restrained fury in her eyes. She was a woman who commanded respect in a drafting room full of men. Yet here her father treated her like an ornament.
She's trapped, Arthur realized with a sudden jolt.
Just like me. We are both just trying to buy our way out.
Miss Hammond is correct, Arthur interjected. His voice was calm, cutting through the rising tension in the room.
Hammond turned to him, bristling.
Excuse me.
A public spectacle is entirely uncouth.
Arthur said, channeling every ounce of aristocratic arrogance he possessed.
He looked down his nose at Hammond, utilizing the exact snobbery he knew the man both craved and feared.
Old money does not perform for investors, Mr. Hammond. If we do this in front of a crowd, society will instantly recognize it as a desperate ploy. They will laugh at you behind their hands.
Hammond paused, the cigar hovering near his mouth.
Laugh ruthlessly,
Arthur confirmed, keeping his face perfectly straight.
A true gentleman proposes in private. It implies intimacy. It implies a genuine attachment, which is what we need the press to believe.
If you want this marriage accepted by the House of Lords, you must let me handle the optics.
Hammond chewed on the end of his cigar, his heavy brows furrowed in thought.
He looked at Arthur's unyielding posture, then at Beatrice.
Fine, Hammond grumbled. private then, but I want the announcement in the papers by Monday morning.
It will be, Arthur said.
He stepped up to the table and picked up the pen Beatrice had laid out. He didn't read the contract. He had already surrendered. He signed his name Arthur Pendleton, Duke of Westford, in bold, heavy strokes at the bottom of the page. He set the pen down and looked at Beatrice. Her brown eyes met his. There was no gratitude in them, but the tight, defensive line of her shoulders had dropped a fraction of an inch.
"Where will you be tomorrow afternoon?"
Arthur asked her, his voice quiet for her ears only.
"At the Surrey site," she murmured back,
"inspecting a drainage failure on the new line."
"I will see you there."
The Surrey construction site was an ugly scar across the lush green countryside. Deep trenches had been gouged into the earth, piled high with displaced clay and chalk. The sky above was a relentless bruised grey, weeping a steady, miserable drizzle that turned the entire site into a treacherous landscape of thick, clinging mud. Arthur's hired cab refused to go past the main gate. The driver took one look at the churned-up road, shook his head, and demanded his fare. Arthur stepped out into the rain. He wore a heavy wool overcoat and a pair of polished leather boots that were entirely unsuited for the environment. Within three steps, the mud sucked at his soles, splattering heavy, dark droplets against his trousers. He didn't care. He kept walking. The sight was chaotic. Men with pickaxes and shovels yelled over the hiss of a steam-powered crane. Planks of wood had been laid down to form makeshift paths over the worst of the sludge, but they were slick with rain and clay. Arthur spotted her near the edge of a massive waterlogged trench. Beatrice was shouting at a foreman. She was wearing a heavy canvas waterproof coat over her dress, the hood pushed back to reveal her dark hair plastered to her skull by the rain. Her hem was ruined, caked in inches of brown mud. "I told you yesterday if you don't reinforce the retaining wall, the runoff will flood the tracks," Beatrice yelled over the sound of the steam crane. "I don't care how much it costs to bring in more timber. Do it." The foreman, a burly man covered in grime, scowled.
"With all due respect, Miss Hammond, your father said to cut corners on the timber. Said it was eating into the margins."
"My father is in London and I am standing in a swamp," she fired back, pointing a mud-stained finger at the foreman's chest.
"You will order the timber, or you will pack up your tools and walk back to the city. Understand?"
The foreman blinked, cowed by the sheer ferocity in her voice.
He tipped his cap.
"Yes, ma'am. Right away."
He hurried off. Beatrice let out a long, frustrated breath, wiping a streak of muddy water from her forehead with the back of her hand.
"You're very terrifying when you want to be," Arthur said, stepping off the wooden plank and onto the soft, muddy bank beside her.
Beatrice jumped, spinning around. Her eyes widened as she took him in. Arthur was soaked. His perfectly tailored coat was heavy with rain, his hair plastered to his forehead. His boots, which had gleamed like dark mirrors an hour ago, were buried under a thick crust of brown clay.
"What in God's name are you doing out here?" Beatrice demanded, shouting over the rain.
"Are you mad you'll ruin your clothes?"
"I told you I would see you today," Arthur said, raising his voice to be heard.
"I thought you meant at the townhouse after I returned."
She stared at him as if he had lost his mind.
"This is a construction site. It's a mud pit."
"I am aware." Arthur took another step toward her, his boot sinking an inch into the muck with a wet squelch. He reached into his pocket and pulled out the black velvet box. Beatrice stared at it. The rain battered against the worn velvet. The mechanical thumping of the site echoed around them, a jarring contrast to the quiet, velvet-lined drawing rooms where proposals were supposed to happen.
"Arthur, stop," Beatrice said, her voice suddenly losing its sharp edge.
She looked around nervously at the workers nearby. Not here. Not in this. Why not? Arthur asked, standing his ground. You said it yourself. My bloodline isn't built on poetry. It's built on coal and iron and transactions. Why should this be any different? He didn't break eye contact. He looked at her wet hair, her ruined hem, the smudge of dirt on her cheek. She was entirely in her element, practical, ruthless, and undeniably real. There was no pretense here, no society watchers, no fathers demanding a show, just a bankrupt duke and a trapped heiress standing in the wreckage of a torn-up field. Arthur unbuttoned his coat with one hand. He didn't look down. He simply bent his right leg and knelt. His knee hit the mud with a heavy wet thud. The freezing dirty water instantly soaked through the fine wool of his trousers, chilling his skin. Beatrice gasped, taking a half step back. Arthur, get up your clothes. Forget the clothes. Arthur said, his voice ringing clear and steady through the rain. He opened the velvet box. The tarnished silver and the scratched sapphire caught the weak grey light. It was my mother's, Arthur said. He didn't offer a flowery speech. He didn't declare an undying love that didn't exist. He offered the truth. It is the only thing of value my family has left that wasn't bought by your father. It is flawed. It is battered. But it is real. Beatrice stared down at him. The rain fell between them, cold and relentless. Her chest rose and fell rapidly under the heavy canvas coat. For the first time since he had met her, she looked entirely speechless. You knelt in the mud, she whispered, her voice barely carrying over the hiss of the steam engine. You told me I was afraid to get my hands dirty, Arthur replied softly, looking up at her. I'm proving you wrong. He held the box up a fraction of an inch higher. I can't offer you romance, Beatrice. Arthur said, his tone dead serious. I can't offer you a heart untouched by resentment or a life free of burden. But I can offer you a partnership. I will fight your father when he tries to cage you. I will shield you from the snobs who look down on your name. And I will never, ever treat you like a transaction again. He took a steadying breath. Marry me. Not for the earldom, not for the estate, but because we can survive this together. Beatrice looked from the scratched sapphire in the box to Arthur's eyes. She saw the mud soaking into his knee. She saw the total, absolute surrender of his pride. Slowly she reached out. Her fingers were cold, calloused, and stained with dirt. She didn't take the box. She pinched the delicate silver band and pulled the ring free from the velvet slot. She slipped it onto her own left ring finger. It was a perfect fit. It's a beautiful ring, Arthur, she said quietly. Then we have a deal, he asked, not moving from the mud. A small genuine smile, the first he had ever seen on her face, cracked through her stoic expression. Get up, Duke, Beatrice said, offering him her muddy hand. Before you catch your death of cold, we have a railway to build. Arthur took her hand. Her grip was strong. He pulled himself up from the mud, the heavy clay dragging at his leg. But as he stood beside her in the pouring rain, he realized something strange. He had lost his pride, his autonomy, and his immaculate trousers. But as he looked at the woman standing beside him, he didn't feel entirely ruined. He felt for the first time in his life like he was standing on solid ground. The wedding was a tactical deployment, masquerading as a sacrament. St. George's Hanover Square was packed to the vaulted ceilings, with a volatile mixture of Mayfair's oldest bloodlines and London's newest bank accounts. The two factions sat on opposite sides of the aisle, eyeing one another like opposing armies across a battlefield. Arthur stood at the altar. He wore his formal peerage robes, a heavy, suffocating mantle of velvet and ermine that felt less like an honour and more like a shroud. The air in the church was thick, choked with the cloying scent of thousands of white lilies Thomas Hammond had shipped in for the occasion. It smelled like a very expensive funeral. The organ thundered. The heavy oak doors at the back of the church swung open. Beatrice did not look like the woman from the mud-soaked trenches of Surrey. She looked entirely uncomfortably constructed. Her father had clearly spared no expense, and it showed. The ivory silk gown was a structural marvel of lace pearls and restrictive boning. The train stretched for yards heavy enough to anchor a ship. She walked down the aisle with her father, her steps rigid. Her face was veiled, but Arthur could read the tension in the tight set of her shoulders. She was gripping her bouquet of white roses, so hard the stems were likely snapping in her hands. Hammond beamed, practically vibrating with triumph, as he presented her at the altar. He slapped Arthur on the shoulder one last time, a jarring heavy thud against the ermine, and stepped back to take his newly minted place in the front pew. Beatrice stepped up beside Arthur. "You look like you're marching to the gallows," Arthur murmured, keeping his voice so low that even the vicar couldn't hear. "I can't breathe," Beatrice muttered back her voice, tight with panic beneath the lace veil. "The corset is laced too tight. If I kneel for the blessing, the bodice is going to crack." Arthur didn't hesitate. "Then we won't kneel." Beatrice turned her head slightly toward him. "The liturgy requires it. The liturgy can adapt." Arthur looked at the vicar, an elderly man who had christened him 28 years ago. Arthur offered a single, imperceptible shake of his head. The vicar blinked confused, but took the cue, subtly adjusting his prayer book. When the time came for the vows, Arthur took Beatrice's hands. Her fingers were ice cold through her silk gloves. He didn't recite the words with the rote, hollow cadence typical of society marriages. He looked directly through the veil, finding her sharp brown eyes, and spoke the vows as if they were a binding legal contract. He meant every single syllable of the protection he was promising. He slid the scratched sapphire onto her finger. It looked strange against the pristine white silk of her glove, a piece of battered reality in a room full of expensive illusions. 3 hours later, the reception at the Hammond townhouse was in full deafening swing. Champagne flowed in rivers. The noise was a sheer wall of forced laughter and calculated networking. Arthur stood by a massive marble pillar, holding a crystal flute he hadn't touched. He was watching his new wife. Beatrice was cornered near the fireplace by the Dowager Countess of Harrington and her son, Lord Harrington, a man whose lineage was as impeccable as his breath was foul. Arthur began to cross the room. The crowds parted for him instinctively, then fascinating industry railways. Lord Harrington was saying, his voice dripping with condescension. He adjusted his monocle, looking Beatrice up and down. "Though one does wonder about the soot, tell me, Your Grace, does one ever truly get the smell of coal out of one's hair, or does one simply grow accustomed to smelling like a furnace?" The dowager snickered behind her fan. Beatrice's jaw tightened. She opened her mouth, the sharp retort forming on her lips. But before she could fire it, Arthur stepped seamlessly to her side. "My wife smells of progress, Harrington," Arthur said, his voice a smooth, icy blade, cutting through the ambient noise of the room. He didn't raise his voice. He didn't have to. Lord Harrington turned his smug smile, faltering slightly, at the look in Arthur's eyes. "Westford, we were just discussing the unique origins of your bride's fortune. Indeed, a fortune built on steel and sweat." Arthur agreed pleasantly, slipping his hand to the small of Beatrice's back. "A far cry from how the Harrington fortune is currently maintained, isn't it? Tell me, Charles, how is the betting book at White's? I heard a rumour that you staked the deed to your mother's hunting lodge on a horse with a limp last Tuesday." The Dowager dropped her fan. Lord Harrington turned the colour of week-old porridge. That is a private matter, Harrington stammered. Everything is private until the creditors arrive, Charles. A lesson I learned the hard way. Arthur took a sip of his champagne, his eyes dead and unyielding. If you ever speak to my wife with that tone again, I will ensure the entire Carlton Club knows exactly how many promissory notes you've signed this month. Enjoy the champagne. It was paid for with coal money. Arthur turned his back on the sputtering lord, gently guiding Beatrice away from the fireplace. They walked into the hallway, away from the worst of the crowd. Beatrice let out a long, shaky exhale. She reached up and practically ripped the heavy veil from her head, crushing the lace in her fist. "You didn't have to do that," she said, her chest heaving against the rigid corset. "I can handle a pompous idiot like Harrington." "I know you can," Arthur said quietly. "But you shouldn't have to. I told you in the mud, Beatrice, I will shield you from the snobs." She looked up at him. The harsh gaslight of the hallway illuminated the exhaustion in her eyes, but also a profound, startled realization. "You actually meant it," she whispered. "I don't make promises I cannot keep," Arthur replied. He reached out his knuckles, brushing briefly against the stiff silk of her sleeve. "Are you all right? Do you need a knife for that corset?" A sudden, startling laugh broke from her throat. It was a real laugh, warm and slightly raspy entirely, unlike the polite titters of the women in the ballroom. "If I cut the laces, the entire dress will collapse into a pile of tulle," she said, shaking her head. "I just need to sit down." "Then let's go home," Arthur said. Beatrice paused, looking toward the heavy front doors. "To the Abbey," Arthur nodded. "To the Abbey." By November, Westford Abbey looked like a war zone. The grand facade of the estate was obscured by a massive grid of wooden scaffolding. The constant rhythmic sound of hammers and chisels echoed across the frosted lawns from dawn until dusk. Masons were rebuilding the west wing. Carpenters were replacing the rotted floorboards in the gallery. Down in the village, every tenant cottage boasted a newly thatched roof and a sealed chimney. The estate smelled of wet plaster sawdust and cold rain. To Arthur, it was the greatest scent in the world. Beatrice had commandeered the small morning room, turning it into a chaotic annex of the Hammond Railway Company. Blueprints for the new Northern Line covered the floral wallpaper, pinned up with ruthless efficiency. Telegraphs arrived twice a day. She ran her empire from a desk covered in dust sheets, and Arthur ran his from the library across the hall. They existed in a strange parallel rhythm. They took their meals together in the cavernous dining room, discussing limestone yields and grain harvests over lukewarm soup. They were allies. They were business partners. But the vast, echoing corridors of the Abbey still kept them safely, politely separate at night. Until Thomas Hammond decided to pay a surprise visit. He arrived on a Tuesday afternoon, accompanied by three large steamer trunks and an unbearable amount of noise. "Westford B." Hammond's voice boomed through the grand hall, easily drowning out the sound of the carpenters working upstairs. He stood in the center of the foyer, looking around critically at the dust sheets and exposed brick. "Good Lord, the place is still a shambles. I thought you'd have the grand staircase finished by now." Arthur emerged from the library, wiping a smudge of ink from his thumb. "Good afternoon, Thomas. Mortar requires time to set, especially in the damp." Beatrice appeared at the top of the stairs, her hair shoved hastily behind her ears, a pencil tucked into her bodice. "Father, we weren't expecting you." "I'm an earl now, Bea. I don't need an invitation to visit my own daughter," Hammond declared, marching towards the drawing room. "Besides, I've brought the guest list. We're throwing a ball." Arthur and Beatrice exchanged a swift, alarmed glance. An hour later, they were sitting in the drawing room. Hammond was pacing the rug, chewing on an unlit cigar, waving a thick sheaf of papers. "Christmas Eve," Hammond was saying. "We'll invite the entire board of directors, the local magistrates, and half the House of Lords. We'll show them what Hammond money can do when it's wrapped in Pendleton history. I want an ice sculpture of a train in the center of the dining table." "An ice sculpture," Arthur repeated flatly. "Father, half the guest rooms don't even have functional fireplaces yet," Beatrice argued, rubbing her temples. "We cannot host a massive ball in a construction site." "Nonsense. You pay the workers double, and they'll have it done." Hammond dismissed with a wave of his hand. He stopped pacing and pointed at the window. "And another thing. I saw that old man pruning the rose bushes out front. Thomas, is it? He took 10 minutes just to cross the gravel. You need to let him go Westford. It's inefficient. I'll send down 3 young lads from my grounds crew in London to replace him." The room went dead silent. Beatrice stood up her chair, scraping harshly against the wood floor. "You will do no such thing. Thomas has been with the estate for 50 years. "Which is exactly why he's useless now." Hammond shot back his face, reddening. "This is a business, Bea. You don't keep broken tools in the shed. You throw them out and buy new ones." Beatrice's hands balled into fists. "This is not your railway, Father. This is a home." "It's an asset," Hammond roared, slamming his fist onto a side table. "An asset I paid £80,000 for, and I say the old man goes, and we throw the ball. Thomas Hammond." The voice was not loud. It wasn't a roar. But the absolute freezing authority in Arthur's tone made Hammond snap his mouth shut instantly. Arthur stood up from his chair. He didn't look angry. He looked like the 9th Duke of Westford. He crossed the room, stopping inches from Hammond. The physical difference was stark. Hammond was broader, heavier, but Arthur possessed a quiet, lethal stillness that made the older man instinctively step back. "You purchased my debts, Thomas," Arthur said, his voice dropping to a low, lethal register. "You purchased my title for your daughter, but you did not purchase me, and you absolutely did not purchase this house." Hammond bristled, trying to rally his bluster. "Now see here, Westford." "No, you will see here." Arthur cut him off effortlessly. "Thomas the groundskeeper stays. If he takes an hour to cross the gravel, he stays. He is my responsibility, not your broken tool. There will be no ice sculptures. There will be no ball on Christmas Eve. You will not turn my family's home into a gaudy advertisement for your stock prices." Arthur held the man's gaze unblinking. "You wanted to marry into the aristocracy, Thomas. This is what it looks like. It is quiet. It is loyal. And it does not answer to you." Arthur tilted his head slightly. "If you cannot abide by those terms, you are welcome to pack your steamer trunks and return to London. But while you are under my roof, you will respect my wife, my staff, and my walls. Do we understand one another?" For a long, agonizing moment, the only sound in the room was the distant tapping of a carpenter's hammer. Hammond looked at Arthur. He looked at the unyielding aristocratic steel in the young Duke's eyes. Hammond was a predator in the boardroom, but he recognized a different kind of apex predator when he saw one. He recognized generations of men who had ruled vast tracts of land before steam power was even a concept. Hammond swallowed hard. He pulled the cigar from his mouth. "Right," Hammond muttered, looking away. "No ice sculpture, then. I'll go see about my bags." He turned and practically fled the room. Arthur stood still, waiting until the heavy footsteps faded up the stairs. The adrenaline drained out of him, leaving him feeling hollow and exhausted. He ran a hand over his face. He felt a light touch on his arm. He turned. Beatrice was standing right beside him. The defensive armored posture she always wore around her father had completely vanished. She looked up at him, her dark eyes wide and incredibly soft. "He's bullied me my entire life," Beatrice whispered. "He's bullied everyone he's ever met. I've never seen a man back him down before." "He forgets," Arthur said softly, looking down at her, "that I have nothing left to lose. He can't threaten me with ruin anymore. You already saved me from that." Beatrice shook her head. "You fought for the groundskeeper. You fought for the abbey." She paused, her fingers tightening slightly on his sleeve. "You fought for me. I am your husband, Beatrice." Arthur said the word, suddenly tasting less like a contract and more like a truth. "I will always fight for you." She didn't step back. She stayed in his space, the warmth of her hand seeping through his coat. The air between them shifted the polite, business-like distance, evaporating into the quiet, dusty air of the drawing room. "Thank you, Arthur," she said. It was the first time she had used his Christian name without a trace of sarcasm. Spring arrived at Westford Abbey, not with a sudden burst of warmth, but with a slow, muddy thaw. The scaffolding came down in mid-April. The west wing stood whole once more, the new stone, pale and clean against the weathered grey of the ancient walls. Down the drive, the fountain in the turning circle was running for the first time in a decade, the water splashing brightly against the repaired stone cherub. It was late on a Thursday night. The abbey was quiet save for the crackle of the fire in the library. Arthur sat at his massive mahogany desk. The mountains of red-tide paper and foreclosure notices were gone. In their place sat a single, leather-bound ledger. He was reviewing the planting schedules for the tenant farms. For the first time in his life, the columns balanced. The black ink was a steady, beautiful march of progress across the page. The door to the library opened softly. Beatrice walked in. She was wearing a simple, dark blue wrapper over her nightgown, her hair hanging loose in thick, dark waves over her shoulders. She carried a cup of tea, her bare feet, silent on the worn Persian rug. "You're still awake," Arthur noted, looking up from the ledger. A warm, immediate ease settled in his chest at the sight of her. "I was finishing the grading reports for the York expansion," she said, stifling a yawn as she walked over to the leather armchair by the fire and sank into it. She pulled her feet up beneath her. "My engineers are insisting the chalk beds are too deep. I had to threaten to fire the lot of them via telegram." Arthur smiled, closing his ledger. "Did they cower?" "Appropriately," she murmured, taking a sip of her tea. Arthur stood up from the desk. He didn't go back to his own chair. He walked over to the fireplace and sat on the low, padded footstool directly in front of Beatrice's chair. She looked down at him over the rim of her teacup, her expression softening. The firelight caught the exhausted shadows under her eyes, but it also illuminated the quiet, profound peace in her posture. She was entirely at home. "The roof on Finch's cottage held through the spring storms," Arthur said quietly, looking into the flames. "He brought up a basket of early strawberries this morning to thank us." "Good," Beatrice said, "though he really should thank the reinforced timber joints. The cross bracing I ordered is practically bomb-proof." Arthur chuckled, shaking his head. "Always the engineer." He reached out and gently took the teacup from her hands, setting it on the side table. Then he took her right hand. Her fingers were still calloused from years of gripping drafting pencils, and there was a faint, permanent smudge of graphite on her knuckle. He ran his thumb over the scratched sapphire of his mother's ring on her finger. "When you came into my drawing room in London," Beatrice said, suddenly her voice low and thoughtful in the quiet room, "you told me you'd rather lose everything than marry me." Arthur flinched slightly at the memory of his own arrogance. "I was a fool. I was drowning, and I was angry at the lifeboat for not being a luxury yacht. I was angry too, Beatrice admitted, leaning her head back against the leather chair. I thought you were a parasite. I thought you were just another hollow aristocrat selling his name to keep his hands clean. I fully expected to spend the rest of my life hating you. Arthur looked up at her. And now? Beatrice looked down at him. She didn't offer a flowery metaphor. She didn't speak of fate or destiny. She gave him the only thing that mattered to her, the honest, unvarnished truth. Now, she said softly, tracing the line of his jaw with her thumb. I think you are the most honourable man I have ever known. I think you are the only person who has ever looked at me and seen a partner instead of a pawn. Arthur caught her hand, pressing a kiss to her palm. The scent of ink and lavender filled his senses. He had spent his whole life terrified of ruin. He had guarded his pride like a fortress, locking himself inside until he was starving to death. It took a woman with a sharp tongue and a head for ledgers to tear the walls down. I didn't lose everything, Beatrice, Arthur whispered, moving closer, his hands resting on the arms of her chair. I lost the debt. I lost the pride that was poisoning me. I lost the isolation. He leaned up his face, inches from hers. I gained everything, he said. Beatrice smiled that rare, genuine smile that still knocked the breath out of him, and closed the distance, pressing her lips to his. It wasn't a tentative, polite kiss. It was deep-grounded and fiercely real. It tasted of tea and warmth, and the absolute certainty of standing on solid ground. Outside, the wind howled around the ancient stones of Westford Abbey. But inside the library, the fire burned bright. The ledgers were balanced in black ink, and the Duke and his Duchess were exactly where they were always meant to be. And that concludes the story of Arthur and Beatrice. If you loved seeing how a bitter business transaction transformed into a profound, unbreakable partnership, built on respect and reality, hit that like button to show your support. Did Arthur's defense of Beatrice against her father have you cheering? Drop a comment down below with your favorite moment. Don't forget to share this video with anyone who loves a historical romance with a fiercely capable heroine, and subscribe to the channel for more grounded, emotional storytelling. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you in the next tales.